Hello and welcome to the November 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. You might have noticed that this month's programme is reaching you later than usual. Unfortunately, due to illness, we had to delay production. Here is what we have in store for you this month. We will have part one of John Townsend's conversation with Ninon Jerome. Part two will appear towards the end of the programme. Fran Frank will be reading a poem on a local theme. Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald will be reviewing this month's book entitled Flowers for Mrs. Harris by Paul Gallico. Aileen Clarkson will be sharing her letter from a dog walker. This month happens to be the Canadian singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell's 80th birthday, and to commemorate her birthday, we will be playing one of her famous songs. Norma Orty will be reading one of her short stories entitled The Song of the Shirt. Valerie Forrester will be reading an article about Exminster Station. I will be sharing a selection of regional British slang phrases and their origins. We will then have part two of John Townsend's conversation with Ninon Jerome. The concluding piece of music will be of Ninon's choice. We start off with John Townsend and his guest.
Hello, I'm John Townsend, and welcome to another of my Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I have the privilege of chatting with talented musicians, actors, singers, and theatrical directors who perform locally and further afield. Today I'm delighted to welcome Ninon Jerome to our Dawlish studio, not that she is a stranger to this room, as she has already joined the Blue Team at Here and Now, so her voice may be familiar. But what won't be familiar is Ninon's fascinating backstory, having been, among other things, a theatrical director in London's West End, among stars of screen and stage. Thank you for popping in for a chat, Ninon.
Well, it's just lovely to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Before you tell us about your theatrical career, I have two burning questions. What is the derivation of your delightful, dare I say, glamorous name? And what brought you to Dawlish, let alone Here and Now? That's probably three questions, actually, but...
Ninon is it's a French name. My father was French, and he chose the name because I was named after Ninon de L'Enclos, who's a famous French character of the 1600s. I thought, because I spend my life in England explaining the name, trying to spell it to people and having people do ambulance sirens at me. So I thought, oh, well, when I go to France, people will know the name and understand, but no, no one's heard of it there either.
So are you bilingual?
I was. I must admit, yeah. I'm a little rusty, but I've joined a very splendid French conversation group in Tynmouth and soon to participate in one in Dawlish as well, just to brush my standards up.
Well, perhaps next year we'll run this interview in French. Shall we? Give it a go. So you're not from Dawlish, so tell me your story of coming to Dawlish.
No, indeed, I'm from London, and well, I always used to come down to Devon as a child on holiday and had some amazing holidays where the sun always used to shine, as it does with childish holidays.
Yes.
My cousin bought a flat down here. He loves it down here as well. And he knew that I was just looking to have a bit of a change from the rat race of London, and so offered me his flat to come in and stay.
And you've not looked back?
I've not looked back. I've been here since April, and I have to say I find Dawlish such a lovely place to be. It's a very friendly and very strong community here. And I came in April, I think there was a very wet May bank holiday, and there was a tent on the lawn, and I thought, well, I'll go in and explore, see what's going on. And there was information about all societies there, including the Talking Newspaper. And I thought, well, that sounds very interesting.
Oh, excellent.
And I just felt, you know, a very, very strong community sense here.
Excellent.
Which I enjoyed.
Good, good. Well, we will just say for our Tynmouth listeners, Tynmouth is also a wonderful place to live.
Oh, yes, yes. I know I do a lot in Tynmouth as well.
Oh, good. Well, according to my research, and you just mentioned it, you were born in London, I think Fulham, not that far from the West End. So presumably, having so many theatres nearby, you ended up, well, falling in love with the magic of live performances, along with the smell of the grease paint and roar of the crowd. Is that so?
That is, yes. I spent much of my childhood going to see shows, and I think one show particularly sticks in my mind. I was taken to the Nutcracker at the Royal Festival Hall, and I just thought it was such a magical experience with lovely dancers twirling in tutus, and I do remember in the interval twirling around on the front walkway by the river, and just imagining myself as a ballerina. I mean, that never came to pass, but perhaps that's to the benefit of the dance world. But it did stir up my love of live performance.
Right. So you were hooked on theatre, and I did you go to pantomimes and things of that sort? Or
we did some pantomimes. We went to the Arts Theatre, and that's in Leicester Square.
Uh-huh.
And I went to a very magical children's performances there as well.
Okay.
And also the Polka Theatre in Wimbledon, which produced shows specifically for children.
Right.
And all of it just sort of stirred up my imagination, really.
So was there a point, you think, when you were a child that you thought, oh, this could be for me, I'd like to do this?
Well, I certainly loved storytelling, and I do remember creating lots of stories for my friends to perform in the playground at school. So I think certainly being of a bossy nature then led to me having a perfect fit as a theatre director, which involves bossing a lot of people about on stage as well.
I bet you were one of those children that charged other children to come and watch performances, either in the playground or your back garden, with a sheet over the washing line as a curtain.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I did that too.
And I think I took all the big parts.
yes, from the costume box. Yes, I know. Well, look, we need to start when you started getting professional doing bossing people about. Did you at school do school productions?
I did get involved in school productions, and that continued when I went to university.
Ah.
And I remember being involved in one production of After Magritte, which is a sort of a weird comedy. And at the age of 18, I ended up playing an old lady lying dead on an ironing board.
As I do.
And I thought, this is very strange casting. But, you know, you give it your best go, and friends politely come along. And I thought, well, it can only hopefully get better from here.
So, did you go to university intending to study theatre, English, whatever?
Well, I studied modern history and English, but
okay.
I did always want to go into the theatre. And I do remember that when my degree was coming to an end, and we had a meeting set up with a careers advisor. And of course, everyone there was going into being accountants and doing things called the milk round, which was a very strange concept to me. But it was really sort of training to be accountants. And
okay.
I had absolutely no desire to do that. And I do remember saying to the careers advisor that I wanted to work in the theatre. And the woman said, well, you'll never do that. You're too short to be a policewoman, so I think you're destined to be a secretary. And that just stuck with me, and it just enraged me so much.
Oh, quite.
And it spurred me on, I think.
Well, good that happened. I think you were at Durham, weren't you?
I was.
A wonderful place to be, I would have thought.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
I remember also being in a production with Julian Sands, because he was in the year above, and we did a lovely production of Midsummer Night's Dream, set by the Enchanted Weir that runs through.
Dare I ask who you were in this play?
I was just one of the naughty fairies at this point.
Okay. Well, we'll come to, when you left university then and were thrown out into the big wide world, what was your first job?
Well, I took me a little while to sort of work my way round, and I ended up doing a mime course for a little while, and then running an antique stall in Camden Market with a friend of mine. And then deciding that I was going to try the route of working in TV production.
Okay.
And wrote off to a lot of companies there. And I finally managed to get some work with a company called Lambeth Films. And I was just the lowliest of the low production assistant. And at this company, we made commercials for television. And one of the big commercials we made was actually with John Gielgud.
My word.
It was for an American company, and it was selling AAA, which to me I thought was something to do with alcoholics. But no, it's for the Automobile Association in America. So
even the great Sir John Gielgud has to stoop to commercials now.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it looked amazing because we had, you know, real fires, and this was in the summer, yeah. So we were all sweating backstage and everything. But I do remember John Gielgud being so charming and this wonderful raconteur, and yeah. Just so lovely to me, the lowliest of the low person making his tea and whatever. But it was an amazing entry into working in the creative world, really.
And I was going to, well, we're going to move on to do some more name dropping in a moment, because I know you've worked with quite a few well-known actors. I wonder, probably later in your career, you spent many a time at glitzy showbiz do's.
And I did.
We might ask you, you know, to spill the gossip a bit later, but let's go on. You were doing, well, commercials then in television. How did you get into live theatre?
Well, I was then working for another TV company, and we were actually working with actors and scripts. And I do remember the director trying to explain a tricky bit of the script to actors, and who wasn't really helping the actor, I thought. And so I went to speak to the actor afterwards, and I felt I had a natural ability to communicate a script to an actor and sort of bring out a better performance. So
yeah.
So that sort of set me on the path of wanting to work as a director rather than trying to do any acting, which I did do some acting, but I just found it an utterly terrifying experience, and I much prefer to watch back from the backstage or amongst the audience
and tell others how to do it. Well, I think on that note, I think time is racing ahead with us, so I think we'll perhaps come back for a second program, if that's all right, to hear about what you got up to in the West End of London with some quite big productions and some of the people you were working with. So thank you so much for starting us off on your career, the story of your career, and we look forward to hearing some more a little later on.
Yes, thank you so much, and yeah, I'd love to come back and tell your listeners a little bit more, but I'm sorry if I waffled off.
No, that's just what we want. So for now anyway, goodbye.
John and Ninon will continue with their conversation towards the end of this programme. Here is Fran Frank to share a poem.
Hello. The following verse refers to the French invasion of Tynmouth in July 1690, when part of the town was burned down. It's entitled The Devonshire Boys' Courage. Brave Devonshire boys made haste away, when news did come from Tynmouth Bay. The French were landed in that town, and treacherously burnt it down. When to the town they did draw near, the French did straightways disappear, because they had then beat them down, and basely burnt poor Tynmouth town. On Holden Hill they did design to draw their men up in a line, but Devonshire boys did make them run when once they did discharge their gun. Brave blue coat boys did watch them so, they to no other place dare go, for if they had returned again, I'm sure the Frenchmen had been slain. Let Monsieur then do what he can. We'll still reign masters o'er the main. Old England's right upon the sea, in spite of France, maintained shall be. No seaman fears to lose his blood, to justify a cause so good, to fight the French who have begun with burning down poor Tynmouth town. The Cornish lads will lend a hand, and Devonshire boys will with them band, to pull the pride of Monsieur down, who basely burned poor Tynmouth town.
That was a very interesting poem about the last invasion by a foreign country on English soil. We must never forget the unsung heroes who gave up their lives to defend our country. Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald are here with this month's book review.
Well, this month, Mary and I have been reading a short, a charming little novel, which has two different names. So in America, it's known as Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, and in the UK, it was published as Flowers for Mrs. Harris. It's the same story, and it's a 1950s novel, and it's all about a charwoman. I don't think we use that word nowadays, but
Not in the 50s,
that was what you use, a cleaner. And she works in London for some quite well-off people. Well, not all of them are that well-off. And it's all about her having this dream about getting herself a Dior dress and eventually going to Paris and getting the dress. But that's just the plot. There's so much more to it.
Absolutely. And it's the characters are so lovely, so believable. The events are not so believable, but that doesn't matter. It's a story, and that's what makes it so sweet. And she's a hard-working girl, has been all her life. She raised her daughter on her own. She has a friend who also is now widowed and has had a family. They're both cleaners, Charles. And the other lady is more of a cook, I think. But they're just the best of friends. They support each other through thick and thin. And Mrs. Harris has one of her ladies is a Dior fan. And quite by chance, Mrs. Harris sees the Dior gown and is totally hooked. Her ambition and ideal in life is to own one of those gowns. She knows it's out of the window. There's no chance. No ordinary lady, no, certainly not a jar in London, is ever going to manage it. But she has a dream.
That's right. And Mrs. Butterfield. Butterfield is her great friend and superb character. She's absolutely brilliant. But she does get the money through various means, mainly saving. It takes her a long time, but there are other adventures on the way. And yes, she goes to Paris in the middle of the 50s, and she stays there for quite a while. And the sort of conceit of the story really is that wherever she goes, she charms everybody. Nice things happen. This is not a novel with anything unpleasant, remotely unpleasant, really happens. And it's a bit syrupy, but it's lovely and it's charming, and you just get swept along and you root for her.
I think that's the point, though, isn't it? Especially written at the time it was. Mm. People wanted a bit of romance, a bit of adventure, a little bit of fun and excitement. And to have people in a mundane life having that excitement, and let's face it, winning £100-odd on the pools, a girl's got to feel innovated.
That's right, because this is the early 1950s, so it's kind of rationing, I guess, is still around or in very recent memory. And in London's a bit dull. And it's like a dream, isn't it, really?
Oh, absolutely.
It's a sweet little fable. And I think he went on afterwards, this is Paul Gallico, the writer, he went on to write several books about Mrs. Harris. She goes to New York, she goes to Moscow in one.
Oh my goodness. She becomes
an MP even in one of them. I've yet to read any of the others, but I was very taken with it.
I am indeed. And as I say, when she gets to Paris, as you say, she charms everyone. from high to low. Obviously, everybody she sees at Dior are very highbrow. Look at her askance, but then realise she has a friend in high places, the Count. But I think that's where the other title comes from, is because she and the Count have an interest in flowers, mm-hmm. and they bond at the market. And, of course, the flower theme does go right through, right to the very end.
Right to the very end. Yes. The ending's very floral.
Very indeed. But also she achieves her goal. What it's like is different in whatever story you see. But there's also a film has been made. I have to say I quite enjoyed the film. And then I read the book and thought, it is not a bit like it. There's an innocence and serenity, really, and honesty about the book. Whereas in the film, they've changed things and brought in aspects that don't need to be brought in. I didn't like the book, the film so much after I'd read the book.
The title of the book that Stephen and Mary have reviewed is Flowers for Mrs. Harris by Paul Gallico. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook. We now have Aileen Clarkson to share her latest letter from a dog walker.
Dear listener, Honey, my lovely sandy-coloured 6-year-old cockapoo, and I took a very late summer holiday in the middle of October. The car was full of everything we could possibly need, including Honey's food, bedding, chair throws, and a lot of treats and toys, and the odd item I might need. The A30 is a road I have travelled along several times, and it has always had some form of roadworks taking place, with the aim of providing continual dual carriageway on its entire length. At Carland Cross, with less than one-third of our journey remaining, we entered an 8-mile diversion. The usual destination signs stopped. The only place that was mentioned was Redruth. I have to admit that when we went round the first diversion roundabout, I went round twice before deciding that Redruth was where we should be heading. Honey Bear is a great traveller and only awakens when the engine stops, which it eventually did in the parking space allocated to the slipway, our ground floor apartment and garden, which overlooks Mounts Bay and Penzance Harbour. We left the car in its parking spot, returning to it only to deposit items not required. I placed the front door key on a tape, which I hung safely around my neck. Penzance is the terminal point of mainline trains, which pass through Tynmouth, and besides the railway station is the bus station, offering routes to St Ives, Land's End, Marazion for St Michael's Mount, Newlyn and Mousel, all of which Honey and I visited. There were several other destinations available as far as Truro, but we stayed local. October is a good time to visit the seaside because most beaches are reopened for dog walking. On a visit to St Ives, with the tide far out beyond the harbour walls, Honey and I walked to the harbour's entrance over bright, creamy yellow sand. Well, I walked. Honey took off and attempted to cover as much of the surface as possible, as quickly as possible, not even stopping when she met other dogs. I could feel her delight at having freedom to run on a very large flat expanse without any obstacles. When she met the rippling sea, she turned back for some more fast running. Soon the tide turned, and a few patches near the harbour wall were filling with water, so we returned to the town for lunch at a splendid dog-friendly restaurant. Honey had some water and went to sleep under the table, while I enjoyed fresh fish and chips and a glass of wine. Before taking the bus back to Penzance, I bought some fresh, soft bread rolls at the St. Ives Bakery on 4th Street and visited the Whistlefish card shop for some birthday cards to add to my store at home. Over the following days, we walked a lot and took the bus to some of the nearby places already mentioned. Honey had lots of energy and would walk all day if required. Twice on our morning walk, we visited the dog-friendly Queen's Hotel for breakfast on our way to Newlyn Harbour to watch the activity around its very busy fishing fleet. On a magical day when the sun was warm, we arrived by a small country bus in the centre of a crowded Mousel. The tide was out, exposing the high harbour walls which form a horseshoe defence for the little fishing village. For lunch, Honey Bear and I found a cafe with wide windows overlooking the harbour. It is really lovely having Honey Bear with me, because people stop to talk to her and then to me. A day we chose to go to Marazine. It threatened rain. So after a short walk, we lunched at the dog-friendly Godolphin Hotel, located directly opposite the causeway leading to St. Michael's Mount. The aim of a holiday is to have a temporary change to the usual routine, and Honey and I definitely enjoyed the change. We sat on the enclosed top of the bus to Land's End on a dull, drizzly afternoon and remained on the bus for the return journey. And now we are home, walking our familiar walks, and I'm finding the air temperature definitely colder. Summer and autumn clothes are packed away for next year, and I don't go out in my padded coat without the addition of a scarf and gloves. Stay warm. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
Now for a song by Joni Mitchell. She originally wrote and recorded her hit song Both Sides Now as a young woman back in 1966. On the occasion of her 80th birthday this month, the version of the song we are going to play for you is the slower and more reflective version, which she recorded in the year 2000. It works much better as the thoughts of a mature woman looking back on her life, reflecting on the wisdom she has gained, still baffled by so much of the world and our lives in it.
Rose and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way. But now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes through. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. And you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take. Still somehow it's love's illusions that I recall. I really don't know love. I really don't know love at all. And feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. Oh, but now, old friends, they're acting strange. And they shake their heads and they tell me that I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I look at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. I recall. I really don't know life. I really don't know life at all.
It's over to Norma Orty with her story.
The Song of the Shirt. My father died when I was 4, and I grew up in an all-female household. My hard-working mother kept us neat and clean. In fresh white school shirt was always ready, crisply ironed. At 18, I went to college to train as a teacher. Every Saturday we washed our clothes and probably ironed them, but I can't remember. I became engaged, and with the wedding only days away, I asked my landlady to teach me how to iron a shirt. In deepest Dorset, I washed shirts by hand until we bought an electric wash boiler, which stood in the kitchen and at times boiled over. Our 85-year-old landlady would not allow me to put washing out in the weekends, and so rugby shirts hung over the bath from one game to the next. With the birth of our son, the wash boiler was supplemented by a spinner rinse machine, which was a boon for nappies. Son number 2 arrived, and we bought an automatic washing machine. My toddler and I sat on the kitchen floor and watched the complete program. It beat play school on TV. There was an embarrassing moment when the machine failed and the repairman found the fault, the toweling liner from my bra. The boys were soon off to school wearing their cute little white shirts, while the faithful machine washed the nappies of son number 3. Relocation to South Africa meant no washing machine at first. Famous brand cold water powder soaked 4 shirts every day, and on my return from school, the ironing was done. Circumstances changed, and some years later, a stepson joined the family. 5 shirts every day. Thankfully, our local school chose beige for their colour. Having a lively mind, I stood at the ironing board and calculated that during his school career, each boy wore 2,600 clean shirts, and add in husband's contribution, and that totaled plus minus 17,440 shirts washed and ironed, and I only counted the formal shirts. After matriculating, each boy did his national service, and suddenly I knew nothing about ironing. On weekend passes, they did their own ironing, admittedly only uniforms. After SOS messages from the older boys, I got wise, and this year the youngest went off with his tube of iron cleaner in his bag.
Norma's story does bring home the fact that we are so reliant on modern appliances, aren't we? Valerie Forrester has an interesting article about Exminster Station.
This is an article by Graham Toombs of the local History Society in Exminster, and it is about Exminster Station. At our September meeting, we had an interesting illustrated talk on Exminster Station and the, quote, avoiding line. Brunel constructed the Great Western Railway from London to Bristol, from where his ships were to provide ongoing travel across the Atlantic. He extended the line to Exeter and St Thomas for the GWR, but then was employed by the South Devon Railway to build the railway on to South Devon and Cornwall. Renaming Paignton, Paignton, as Paignton, Paignton, in the process, because they did not want their rail travel associated with pain. It was not until the London South Western Railway came to Exeter via Salisbury and used the GWR rails between Exeter and St David's Station and Cowley Bridge Junction as part of their North Dartmoor routes to North Devon, Tavistock and Plymouth, that Exeter St David's became a major station. Originally, the GWR and South Devon Railway tracks were laid to Brunel's gauge of 7 feet and 1/4 inch. Later laid as dual gauge with the standard gauge of 4 feet 8.5 inches. And finally, a standard gauge only after 1892. Because of the steep gradients west of Newton Abbot, Brunel initially intended to use the vacuum system for traction between Exeter St David's and Totnes. The atmospheric system with its vacuum pumping stations at Exeter St Thomas, Countess Weir, Turf, Starcross, Dawlish, Tynmouth, Summerhouse and Newton Abbot was put into use. The atmospheric pipes and their pumping stations were built as far as Totnes, but never put into use because of the adverse experiences of operating to Newton Abbot, and the whole system was abandoned and traction reverted to steam locomotives. Initially, no station was planned by the South Devon Railway for Exminster. Mr. George Hennell saw the need for a station to serve what was then known as the Exminster Lunatic Asylum, and built it privately eventually, selling it to the South Devon Railway. There was also the Railway Inn, where visitors to the asylum and railway passengers could alight and take refreshments. Traffic increased such that the original single track had to be doubled by 1891, and sidings were also added to the station for coal and cattle traffic, requiring a signal box which had to be enlarged in 1924. A second bridge had to be built over the railway on the Exminster side for more sidings. The first station master was a Mr. Campbell. In 1905, the station was provided with gas lighting and a water tower for replenishing locomotive water supplies for stopping trains. Expresses had been able to take up water on the move from troughs laid between the rails in 1904. A lot of freight wagons seem to have been stored in the sidings, and some were used to transport bananas, which had been stored for ripening at a plant in Heathfield, to London. 27,000 passengers passed through Exminster Station in 1923, and had reduced to 945 by 1959. The last station master left in 1955, and the last passenger train left on the 28th of March 1964. There was so much traffic west of Exeter that the section around the coast to Newton Abbot became a serious bottleneck, particularly during summer holidays. So the GWR planned for an additional twin track line known as, quote, the avoiding line, to run behind Dawlish and Tynmouth through a series of tunnels and on some high embankments, commencing at Dawlish Warren and terminating at Newton Abbot. By 1936, the GWR had in place an Act of Parliament permitting the work and had purchased all of the land needed. A start was made in 1939 by laying some short sections of track from Newton Abbot towards Tynmouth, when all work had to stop because of the start of World War II.
British slang phrases. I have been fascinated with British slang phrases and their meanings and origins, although it is not always possible to find the exact origins of most of them. Here are a few that I am sharing with you. Sling your hook. This is a polite way of telling someone to go away. This phrase most likely originated amongst sailors and dock workers. The hook refers to a ship's anchor, and the sling was the cradle that housed the anchor. Therefore, To sling your hook meant to lift anchor, stow it, and sail away. Hop it or op it. This is British slang to rudely tell someone to go away. Stop mithering me. This phrase is commonly used in the north of England, meaning to stop bothering me. To stick your oar in. This phrase means to give someone your opinion when it is not required. It originates from a line in Charles Coffey's 1731 play, The Devil to Pay, which reads as, I will govern my own house without your putting in an oar. In and out like a fiddler's elbow, meaning useless overactivity. This is Irish slang to describe a person who cannot stay still. It is also widely used in the north of England. Couldn't fight his way out of a wet echo. A Liverpudlian slang, echo refers to the local tabloid newspaper. This saying means a pathetic person. See you directly. This is a Devonian and Cornish saying, meaning see you later, which could be any time from a few hours, days, weeks, or months. It is the equivalent of the Spanish word mañana. Drawing your mouth abroad is a Devonian saying, meaning yawning. Buttoned up the back. This is a Glaswegian saying, meaning being taken for a fool. Black over Bill's mothers. Birmingham slang for black clouds are coming. Bill refers to William Shakespeare, which means the rain clouds are coming from Stratford-upon-Avon. Put wood into oil. This is Yorkshire slang for shut the door. On the huh. This is a Norfolk and Suffolk phrase meaning crooked or not level. Keep a throshin. This is a Suffolk phrase meaning keep on doing a good job. The word throshin comes from threshing or beating the corn during harvest. All around the reekin. This is a Shropshire phrase for a long and winding way to get to a particular place, thing, or conversational point. These are just a few of the British slang phrases. Whilst researching these, I discovered that neighbouring counties shared the same or similar phrases. It reveals quite a lot about how people travelled from one region to another and took their language and culture with them. I am sure you know many more, and if so, please do share them with us. At the risk of mispronouncing Welsh phrases, I haven't attempted any of them. Perhaps Valerie will enlighten you with some of those in the future. Here is part two of John Townsend's conversation with Ninon Jerome.
Hello, I'm John Townsend and welcome back to Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I have the privilege of talking again to Ninon Jerome, a theatrical director from the West End. Now, Ninon, last time we were talking, we got to the point of you were directing or assisting with commercial advertisements, I think, with people like John Gielgud and others. And you were doing this, whereabouts were you doing that, in London?
That was in London, yes.
Right. Indeed.
And then I moved to Bristol.
Uh-huh. And what was this into the theatre?
This was working for another TV company, but whilst I was there, I decided to take myself off to the Bristol Vic Theatre School and put myself on the director's attachment to work on my skills as a director and to develop those.
Okay. And once you'd got these skills under your belt, you were let loose on the world of theatre, I assume?
I was. As part of the course we did, I did a showcase of Bouncers, John Godfer, which is a very fun and silly production. But it just went down so well. I was able to bring it to the Theatre Museum in London. And then we also took it up to the Edinburgh Festival as well. It was just an amazing experience. The actors were wonderful to work with, and I thought, yes, this is the time.
So what sort of period are we talking now? In the 80s-ish?
This is early
90s. Early 90s, okay. Yeah, Edinburgh must have been fantastic.
It's a mad and crazy place, and it just gets even more mad and crazy, but it's my idea of heaven.
Oh, well, that's good. And so the Old Vic Theatre School, and did you do any productions at the Old Vic Theatre?
I assisted on a couple of productions there, including Love's Labour's Lost, and it was just a very wonderful, inspiring and creative time. Mm-hmm. I still keep in touch with some people from the school today. Yeah. And it kind of provided a huge platform, really, for me to start my career properly, professionally as a director. And from there, I was offered work as an assistant director at the Orange Tree Theatre in Richmond, which is a lovely theatre, but it's based, every production is done in the round. So you really have to learn your skills as a director there, because you can't have much in the way of scenery, and the actors feel very exposed, and you have to make sure that the sight lines, you know, everyone can see. And they worked on very classical productions at the Orange Tree when I was there, and it was a very good training ground for working on scripts and bringing out all the nuances.
Yeah.
From there, I worked at the Travis Theatre and did a piece of new writing with the star was Dougray Scott, who does sort of movies now. He was at that point just starting out on his career. And I worked at the Almeida Theatre. It was on a play written by David Hare, who would sometimes come to rehearsals and then just fall asleep on the chaise longue at the back, and you'd hear these little snoring snuffles at the back.
But he must have been happy with what you were doing.
He was very, very happy, I think, just very chilled.
And who was in that production?
And we had, the most famous person at that point was Richard Griffiths. Was just such a lovely person, he really was, but just, again, in the style of Gielgud, a lovely raconteur. So we would rehearse for about half an hour, and then Richard would go off on these wonderful stories, and that would take twice the time. And then we go, should we go back to rehearsing then?
Nice work if you can get it, I think. So I'm not sure how it works. Did you choose the plays, or were you employed by somebody to do them?
Well, at that point, I was given plays to work on with actors, but given carte blanche, sometimes they would come with actors attached to it, but mostly given carte blanche to cast it. If you're approaching a named actor, then you would very rarely go through the audition process. You would go and meet them and have a nice chat over a cup of tea or something, and then talk about the script, and then you would make the approach to the actor's agent, and then they would let you know whether they wanted to work with you or not.
I see. Fantastic. Well, it sounds very interesting. And I'm sure you've probably over the years done dozens and dozens of productions. So let's talk about the ones that stick in your mind, or actors that stick in your mind. We've heard a few names. I gather you worked with Vanessa Redgrave.
I did, yes, and her brother Corin. I went to work for the King's Head Theatre, which is the original pub theatre in London. That was a little powerhouse, because we would work on plays and produce them. This one was Separate Tables by Rattigan.
Oh, yeah.
And it was given the twist that it was more like we felt Rattigan had intended. So it was a thwarted love, but the main lovers were homosexual, which Rattigan was. This produced a lot of interest, and the production went into the West End, and at that point Vanessa Redgrave and Corin joined it, and it went into the Vaudeville Theatre, into the West End, and received some great reviews.
And I have to ask this, were they easy to work with? Because, you know, there are reputations we hear, but...
They were, actually. They were absolutely charming. They were very, extremely professional and superb and easy to work with. If you were then having a cup of tea, you would... Because their political views were very strong,
yes.
So you would know to...
Yes.
Well, you should never talk about politics or religion, I feel. So you would sort of...
Okay. And then you were telling me earlier you worked with a wonderful English actress of screen, particularly, Susanna York.
I did. That was one of my early assistant roles when I was asked to assist her directing. And I remember going to meet her in her... kitchen in this lovely house she had in Wandsworth, and we were chatting and talking about the play, and then the time came for me to go, and I remember chatting to her, and in my mind all I could think was, I'm in Susanna York's kitchen, I'm talking to Susanna York. And then I was about to go in, and I said, oh, have I got the job? And she said, oh yes, of course. And we became firm friends over the years.
Yeah.
And I then had the honour of directing her in a Tennessee Williams, and she was an absolute delight and amazing actress.
Ah, wonderful. Mind you, she was probably sitting in her kitchen thinking, I'm talking to the great Nino.
I think she was. I was very, very early on. But no, she was absolutely charming. She really
lovely.
Was.
So obviously with all these productions, would you actually pick out one or two that will always stay with you?
I suppose the production I worked on, which I think was the most incredible, was Cavalcade, just purely in terms of the scope, because it has a core professional cast. And then wherever the show toured to, we would work with a roughly 300 amateur theatre groups. So we were rehearsing people into the show. We went ahead and worked with them so that they would know where to go and how to be in the show.
That's a huge amount to manage. You were in charge of that, were you?
I was. I do remember when we were in Brighton, and this is hence why I chose the song I have.
Yes, we'll talk about that in just a moment, yes.
And because the amateur groups in Brighton were just amazing, and they were so professional, and they performed this song so well.
Ah.
But it was quite tricky to balance the demands of a professional cast and an amateur cast. And I remember that because we had Gabrielle Drake playing one of the leading roles. Cavalcade follows the fortunes of a family from the end of the Boer War to about the early 1920s.
Yes, this is Noel Coward, of course.
Noel Coward.
Yes.
I do remember having to go and see Miss Drake because there was a little problem. That she had a very poignant scene where she was waving her only son off to the First World War, to the front. And just as she waves him off, just at that very moment, passing her would be two people carrying an injured soldier on a stretcher. The people who are carrying the stretcher were from various amateur groups, and the timing was never right. And I do remember being called aside and could this possibly be worked on so I rehearsed with the stretcher bearers, thought this is it, we've nailed it. Come the performance, and so it's Gabrielle Drake waving off to her son, and no stretcher appeared this time.
Oh.
And so I went backstage after and said, what happened? And they put the stretcher on the floor for the injured soldier to get on, and they got it stuck on the only nail sticking out of the stage, and they couldn't lift the stretcher.
So you literally nailed it, really, didn't you? Yes, artistic temperaments must have been quite tricky at times, but we won't ask who was the worst. But we've been talking about Cavalcade, and you've mentioned your song of choice. So shall we just talk about that, why you've chosen it? Well, I suppose that was one of your big productions. But it's also about, I think, about behaving not quite so well at the seaside as you would in town. Is that
That's
it?
That's right. Well, I think I just love English music hall, and just sort of the lovely sort of cheeky songs.
Yes.
I just think it's so suitable for being in Dawlish and having fun by the seaside.
And it's, I think, sung by the great Stanley Holloway.
Stanley Holloway.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ninon, for telling us about your, quite speedily, I know there's so much more you could have told us, about your career in the theatre in London. And hopefully we will see you directing, who knows, around these parts. But we will finish by saying thank you very much, and we'll hand over to Stanley Holloway.
Have you ever noticed when you're by the sea, the things that people do there with impunity? If they did the same things when they're up in town, model Mrs. Grundy on her face would wear a frown. Father, mother, all the family, toddle down to have that little paddle by the sea. Mother takes her stockings up upon the sandy shore and shows a lot of linen that she'd never shown before. You can do a lot of things at the seaside that you can't do in town. Fancy seeing mother with her legs all bare, paddling in the fountain in Trafalgar Square, bobbing up and down in the water, it would make the policeman frown. You can do a lot of things at the seaside that you can't do in town. You can do a lot of things at the seaside that you can't do in town.
Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guest Ninon Jerome, Fran Frank, Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Aileen Clarkson, Norma Orty and Valerie Forrester. Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.